Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
State your intentions, Ben Sternke.
One, record podcast intro. Two, get ready for a spiritual direction appointment. Three, work on my sermon. Four, get ready for another spiritual direction appointment. Five, meet you for a meeting later this afternoon. Six. No, that's all I got. Five.
I don't know
what I'm going to do after that meeting. Oh, wait. Six. Run some errands. I need to go to Target today.
Christy, your turn.
Pack for vacation.
Heck yes. Where are you going?
Holland, Michigan. I'm going to see my mom. Mm. So.
Yeah. I'm going to see Oma.
Oma, yes. So this will be great.
Are you flying?
Listen, Ben, you just made my day terrible. No.
Oh, sorry.
Like, pretty much after this.
Did you forget that you weren't flying?
After this intro, I'm going to get in a car with five out of my six kids, and I'm going to start driving.
Oh, my. How long is
17
that?
17 hours.
17 hours. Are you staying? Are you driving through, or are you
going to
stay
somewhere? Well, we never
know. Okay.
I mean... Everything is up in the air.
Okay.
My life this past week has been full. And so we're not even packed yet. So I'm like, we're just taking a vacation, you know, attitude towards our vacation. But we are leaving today.
I like that. Yeah,
you know?
I like that. That's a good, I feel like that's a low stress way of dealing with maybe what could feel like a high stress situation. I feel like you're handling it really well.
Thank you.
Way to go. You're not getting stressed about the fact that you're not prepared. You're just like, well, maybe this is how it's going to be. And
maybe this is part of the vacation.
That's just going to be fine. Yeah.
The adventure.
I love that.
And
do you end up coming through Indianapolis, or does your route not take you through us?
It's like probably way far out of the way. Yeah, it goes through Chicago.
So.
But okay. Matt, what are your intentions?
No, thank you. I intend to have none.
I prefer not to.
I actually am also packing for vacation. We leave tomorrow morning.
Oh my gosh, you guys.
We're driving to South Carolina. I'm going to stay on the beach with my dad and my sister's big family vacay.
Oh my gosh.
For a week.
Fun.
Yeah, so I also have to pack. I have nothing ready.
But don't worry, it's tomorrow.
It's tomorrow.
Yeah. Plenty of time.
And even if it was today,
that's future Matt's problem.
It doesn't matter. Although you're flying, so it does matter.
Oh, yeah. You probably need to get that right.
The only thing I have, the only thing I intend to do other than pack is continue our Gen Alpha vocab quiz from last time. Are you ready?
Was this last time? I guess it was the last
time. No, last time we were all together, bro.
Okay. All right.
Last time for Christy.
It's been a hot second.
It has been.
Real quick, just a listener note from last time. Somebody reached out. We started with the word "yeah" last time, and a friend of mine correctly identified that as AAVE, or as he called it, Ebonics. So a lot of Gen Alpha, Gen Z slang starts with the Black community.
Hmm.
It's created by like Black subculture, youth culture. And then it's quickly adopted or appropriated into more mainstream culture. And his point, my friend Michael's point, was, this is kind of ubiquitous. It kind of happens whether we want it to happen or whatever. It just happens. And sometimes it happens. Most of the time, it happens unintentionally, right? So it's just a word or phrase gets used, and then once it's like a second degree of separation, nobody knows where it comes from, and people just propagate it and repeat it.
Yeah.
But he said it's actually important to name that because Black youth don't appreciate typically how much power they have to create culture.
Mm.
And they need to hear and understand regularly that what they create is significant and matters, and people use it. So, anyway.
That's like the whole history of rock and roll.
It's the whole history of
right
and blues
and jazz
and jazz.
It all, right? It all originated there.
So it's important to probably say that. I'm not quite sure how much of this slang comes from AAV or Ebonics, but just assume that a good portion does.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Remember the rules.
Say your name.
You got to say your name, and then you have to tell me what the meaning is.
So you say your name to buzz in?
You buzz in with your name.
Okay.
Okay.
Hold on, write this down.
All right.
Just kidding. I think I got it.
And all right. The first word is mewing.
Ben. Mewing?
So slow.
Mewing.
I just decided I was going to buzz in whether I knew it or not. just to try to have something. So mewing, caveat, I have no idea what this means, but here's what I think it probably
No,
could
I think
mean.
I do. Okay, guess. Okay,
well, let me, you'll get a chance to steal or whatever, however the rules work. Mewing is a state where someone is overcome by the cuteness of something. They are mewing.
Wrong.
Okay.
Although by the time this airs, maybe the meaning has expanded to include that. Remember, we talked last time that these meanings are expansive, that is not the current meaning of the word mewing. Christy, would you like to give it a shot?
Yeah, I'm going to say, okay, I think it also is somehow connected to like your face and what you do.
Yes.
And so like they like tighten their jaw and they you know, take their thumb and like move it from their ear to their chin. And it's like supposed to be this like, hey, I'm pretty attractive.
Christy, that is really, really close. So mewing is a technique where individuals position their tongue on the roof of their mouth, aiming to improve their jawline aesthetics.
Okay. So it did have something in the jaw.
It's kind of the way, it's like you when you take a selfie or you're on a stream, you are trying to create a more chiseled jawline, a better aesthetically looking face by mewing.
Kind of like sucking Zoolander did all the time.
Right.
Like Zoolander's faces.
Yeah. Okay.
The ones he was like, didn't he copyrighted them, but they all looked the same?
Yes. Yeah.
Such a
and
funny
movie. He was maybe the originator of mewing.
Maybe he was.
He was. Yeah.
All right, second word. Remember to use your name to buzz in.
Okay.
Sigma.
Christy. Okay. Okay, so there's sigma, there's alpha, there's beta. We're not talking about math. But it's
or Greek
like,
letters.
Or Greek letters. It's like the way in which I think guys, I don't know if girls, but I think it's guys, like are in with their crowd of people and if they're the leader or the follower.
But what's the sigma?
So then is the sigma the follower or the leader?
I'm going to say that I think that maybe that's where it originated from, but I think now they just use it for kind of like, that's cool. That's sigma. That's my answer.
Okay, Ben. would you disagree?
I would say, here's what my guess is going to be. I would say it's a way of sort of bucking against the alpha culture. Like, you need to be an alpha, you know, if you're going to be like cool. And then like people who are trying to be alphas, but they're not, are betas. Mm. And I feel like sigmas is like, you know what? We're just way down there in the alphabet and we don't care. And so we're just claiming it. Sigma. We don't care. I don't care if you're an alpha, beta. I'm not playing that game. I'm a sigma.
Yeah. I think Christy is more correct.
Okay.
I like your guess, though,
yeah,
Ben.
Thanks.
Good job.
But I have fun guessing. So.
Yeah, sigma is a term usually for male to describe someone who's independent, self-reliant, and successful. Oh. And usually it's somebody. And Ben, this is where maybe it actually is a greater compliment than alpha. So a sigma is superior to an alpha, but it also is a subtle critique of alpha beta.
Yeah.
So it's like not that duality, but it's like a super.
Right. So in some ways, I'm not playing position. That game. I'm not playing your silly games.
You get a half a point, I think, for sure.
Half
Ben.
A point. Great.
Yeah. And then, you know, it can also then expand the meaning to like a charismatic somebody. Or a sigma than as somebody who's got charisma or independent or successful or moxie, etc.
I see.
All right. So then, final one for today is a phrase. And the phrase is, what the Sigma?
Christy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just like a replacement for what the heck. Because they say it all the time.
and if it means something other than that,
I'm in real trouble as a mom.
It expresses surprise or confusion or annoyance.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is where like
word in there?
Yeah. Well, this is where
this is how slang
this is why I wanted to do this. And for the three listeners that find this interesting, is because Sigma is this riffing off of Alpha and Beta. And then Sigma takes on a life of its own as an exclamatory word that is not even really related to its common use. Right. It's just like it's like recruited from its common use and then used as a, you know, what the heck?
It's kind of like how we've used the word Smurf. You can use it for anything now. Yeah. Remember back in the day, you could say Smurf all the time?
No, you guys are laughing.
Oh my gosh. You could. You could be like, what the Smurf? Or that's so Smurf. Or like it can mean good or bad. But I feel like you can do that with Sigma. It could be like whatever you want. Like you could say it 10 different ways and just fill it in.
All right. Well, I learned something today about Gen X slang.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm right. I guess, listener, you can tell me if I'm right about that.
Yeah,
Do you remember Smurf, Ben?
I don't remember it being used. I remember the, I do remember the TV show Smurfs.
Yeah, that's.
And I feel like the TV show, they just put Smurf in everything, right?
Yes.
It's like, oh, this is, it's the girl Smurf. She's Smurfette. Right. And and then they would just sort of insert it into everything. It's like they would just use that word all the time. So maybe that did take on. I don't think it did in my community growing up take on. Like we didn't copy the Smurfs. But I remember the Smurfs being like, you know, they just named everything Smurf. Yep. They were super into themselves.
Yep.
I guess.
Like Sigma.
Yes.
There's a new Smurf movie coming out, isn't there? They're just like they keep rotating through these. These old TV shows making new movies.
Do they?
Because the 80s were great because everybody loved the 80s.
Yeah. Or movie execs don't want to take a huge risk anymore. Maybe that's it.
So. Anyway. All right. Well, you know who's not a Smurf? Lee Camp. And we're talking to him today. Lee Camp is an award-winning teacher and professor of theology and ethics at Lipscomb University in Nashville, Tennessee. He has a graduate degree in moral theology, a PhD, actually, from the University of Notre Dame, and he is the award-winning podcast host of No Small Endeavor. Today, we talk to him about his tour that he went on, a live tour of this podcast, and also what he's interested in right now, which is all the things that have to do with human flourishing, which I'm a big fan of.
Yes.
It's better than the alternative.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get into this with Lee. Lee Camp, welcome back to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thank you, Matt. It's good to be with you and Ben. Appreciate the invitation to be back with you.
Yeah, we wanted to chat with you today about No Small Endeavor, your podcast that just went on a little mini tour. Tell us a bit about how that tour went and an intro to the podcast for those who aren't familiar.
Yeah, so we our podcast, we started back in 2020 and got that rolling, and then that became a Nashville public radio thing. And then I guess a year and a half, 2 years ago, we got syndicated with PRX, a national syndication. So we're various places around the country. And then as a part of that this year, we decided we'd experiment with a little tour. And so we got Malcolm Gladwell and Drew Holcomb and a full band and some other artists to all get on a bus with us and go. And we did three stops, and then we were actually scheduled for a second go around. So we got the first week done, and we got back, and the promoters told us we hadn't done enough for the second week. So we actually had to cancel the second week, which was pretty embarrassing to have to do that in public. But I must say that the first week was wonderful, and it was an amazing experience, and it was really lovely. So we learned a lot and learned how to do it better next time. Yeah. And but yeah, it was a wonderful first shot at doing that kind of touring thing.
Was that I'm curious, you know, when a podcast goes on tour, you know, our podcast, I imagine No Small Endeavor is similar. I've heard a few episodes. You have a guest on, you know, every time it's a little bit different. When you go on tour with the same people, is it kind of like a show that you're doing the same thing in each location? Is that kind of how it works?
It's very different than our podcast. So it's more like a variety show. And so we have a house band, and so what Malcolm Gladwell and I decided to do is that we wanted to tell some stories in part one. And so we had a story that we were especially telling stories about Frederick Douglass, the famous abolitionist, and the suffragettes. And so Malcolm and I would take turns kind of doing these stories in part one, interwoven with music that was kind of, some of it was period pieces. And then once we got to the intermission, we'd kind of gotten to a stopping place in those stories. So we came back in part two, and then Malcolm and I did a conversation about those stories. So kind of like set up a text in part one, conversations about the text in part two, with a lots of wonderful music interwoven throughout. So it was pretty tightly, parts of it were very tightly choreographed and tightly scripted. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it in the second half with the give and take between Malcolm and myself was extemporaneous and was different each night as we both got more and more. He got more and more comfortable with poking at me. And, and so it got more and more entertaining to the audience as we went along.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. Well, No Small Endeavor, I think, focuses on sort of what it means to live the good life and what constitutes and foments human flourishing. And I'd love to talk about that phrase, the good life.
Yeah.
How did that become a compelling topic for you?
Yeah. I mean, there may be a number of elements to try to answer that question. One would be that in 2013, I went through for about 2 years, two, maybe 3 years, I was in a nasty depression. And I had been prone as a younger person, even since I was very young, I could be prone to melancholy, but I had never had a depression until I had that in 2013 to 15. And so it was nasty. And so when I was coming out of that, I started rereading, you know, some stuff I'd read in graduate school and kind of refreshing myself on things that I knew, but with a new kind of frame. And so I'm looking at, you know, Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, in which he's asking the question of, you know, what does it mean to have this eudaimonia, this sort of flourishing existence? I started rereading and thinking about Aquinas, who obviously in the Christian tradition picks up Aristotle and asks these similar sorts of questions. I started thinking again about Irenaeus, who talks about the glory of God as a human being fully alive. And what does it mean to be fully alive? What's that entail? What's that look like? What constitutes that? And at the same time, I also started reading a lot of this fascinating research that's been done in the last 20 years or so in social science and neurosciences on human flourishing and human happiness. And so one thing led to another. I ended up doing an undergraduate course after I had gone to a thing at Yale that Miroslav Volf had done on joy. And I developed a new class called Joy and the Good Life. And so I started teaching that to undergraduate students, and I did that 7-8 years or so. And it was a remarkable sort of response from students because they were given this sort of comprehensive way, holistic way to think about their lives that was theologically grounded, but it was highly practical. And, you know, we were talking about things as practical as sleep and diet and exercise while also talking about eschatology and while also talking about faith, hope, and love. And so it was this beautiful way to kind of hold all of that stuff together in this compelling, coherent way. And so then somewhere along the way, with the podcast, we started using that kind of construct, exploring what it means to live a good life. Because, you know, in any kind of teleological account of life, you have some sort of notion of what the good is. And so when you keep it exploratory, exploring what it means to live a good life, now all of a sudden you have a space to talk to Christians and non-Christians, Buddhists, Muslims, agnostics, atheists, all of whom have an opinion about what it means to live a good life. Yeah. And so it cultivates fascinating sets of fascinating context for really interesting conversations with very diverse set of people.
We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
It feels like a very universal pursuit, right? That we're seeking. It's maybe even part of what it means to be human is to be a creature that is seeking a good life, seeking, desiring, you know, something more than just raw or bare existence. And I was thinking about how our political economy, like a lot of the promise of the American dream, for example, is rooted in sort of this vision of the good life, human flourishing, that kind of a thing. And so, you know, part of the way that our consumer economy does that is it sort of tries to install these hopes and dreams about the good life in like these products, you know, that I can buy. And, you know, if I click on the button, you know, I can get it here within hours sometimes. I'm sometimes amazed at how quickly Amazon can get something from a warehouse to your doorstep. And there's an implicit promise in that, you know, I think about the good life. And I wonder, you know, from your perspective as a Christian, how does the Christian faith offer us a counter story to what we oftentimes hear through the advertising media?
Right. Well, before trying to answer that question, which is an excellent question, I wish I knew, and I don't know, but it's curious to me that in the American context, the phrase the good life so often connotes a consumerist ideal.
Yes.
And that's a strange commentary on a culture, I think, that the good life could be a consumerist vision. But obviously, in the big sweep of moral philosophy and the Christian tradition and other substantive religious, historical, philosophical traditions, there would have been no such conceit, right? They all knew, the Stoics, the Jews, the Muslims all know that you can't equate whatever you mean by good life, you can't equate it with consumerist life. But we've done that somehow successfully, yeah, or unsuccessfully, however you want to think about it. And so I think that one of the things that's so interesting is that even in the social science work that's been done on human flourishing knows the dangers of knows that that's a lie, knows that the consumerist ideal is a lie. You don't have to be Christian to know that it's a lie. So, you know, I tell my students about this study that was done. I forget now who it was done by, but they surveyed thousands of college freshmen. And to try to assess, and they had a scale by which they could assess how materialistic their attitudes were. And what they found by tracing them longitudinally, you know, 20 years out, they discovered that people who had more so-called materialistic attitudes as college freshmen had a much higher incident rate of reporting upon their life having been unsatisfactory, unhappy, and higher incident rates of mental illness. And so it's like the social science can tell us this stuff doesn't work. It doesn't fulfill its promise. But the marketers are very good at making us think it provides something that it cannot provide. And so I think, you know, coming at it from this very realistic perspective is helpful. From a Christian perspective, I mean, I think, it, you know, there are lots of obvious ways in which our story points to a different set of considerations for what a good life is going to entail and the care that we must take in thinking about desire. And so, you know, in many ways, this is a conversation about desire, right? And the proper formation of desire. And so there's been much done in the Christian tradition about paying attention to the proper formation of desire, and that if our desires are not properly formed, then not only does it not make us happy, it makes us supremely unhappy and attached, and if not, you know, utterly destructive to what anybody is going to call a good life.
Yeah, that's helpful. I'm also thinking of maybe another force that works maybe on the other side of consumerism. If consumerism is the promise of the good life via goods and services, maybe another force that's prevalent in our world today is identifying threats to the good life. And if we gang up on the threats and defeat the threats, then we can have the good life. I know like 15 years ago now, one of the books I've read of yours that I'm familiar with is Who Is My Enemy? Questions American Christians Must Face About Islam and Themselves. And, you know, 15 years ago, we were coming out of maybe the war on terror, and there were a lot of promises made that if we defeat this threat of radical Islam, then America, we will have safety, right? And we will have the good life. I wonder, if you were to update your book today, if you were to write that book today, what issues or cultural phenomenon would you focus on as it pertains to maybe false ways of trying to achieve the good life?
Well, I'm glad that you're one of the few people who read that book, Matt.
Hey, I'll vouch for it.
Yeah. Of my three books, that was the one that was read the least, which I always felt sad about. But I think that the thread that's run through all three of the books I've gotten to do has been a sort of critique of, sometimes implicit, sometimes explicit, as a critique of Christian nationalism. And so the way in our day in which we have this resurgence of Christian nationalism, and the way that is wed to the notion of American exceptionalism and the conceit that an exceptional America can preserve for us a so-called good life. You know, I think that is continuing throughout our cultural trends, continuing in our cultural trends, and it's deeply disturbing and distressing. And so I think, you know, there are a lot of people doing good work on this, and yet the ascendancy of it continues, and I think it is something that we need to continue to pay a lot of attention to and give people in the pews a lot of resources to combat this, because it's an idol that obviously is very compelling to a lot of people. And so finding ways to let people know the very basics of the Christian tradition that undercut that stuff, I think, is incumbent upon all of us.
Yeah.
You know, that brings up for me a question about what you referred to earlier about your show, about how focusing on the good life allows you to talk with atheists and, you know, people from various faith traditions and, you know, all kinds of different people that come from various traditions and perspectives. What is important to you about that as a Christian? Because it's not like you've abandoned your faith. You're still a Christian person. What is important to you about, as a Christian, talking about the good life with other people that you're not debating necessarily? I mean, maybe you have some disagreements and that kind of thing, but there's not a coercive element to it where you're like, I'm gonna debate the atheist and turn him into a Christian by the end of the episode, you know, that kind of a thing. Like, what for you is important about that charitable, open, conversational dynamic about the podcast with people that are not Christians, who don't come from your faith tradition?
Yeah. I think that for me, that's not merely a strategy, but is a is part and parcel of what it means for me to claim a Christian faith. And I've been given the opportunity to do this kind of in public. And I just continue to find that it's, you know, it's a joy to get to do. And that there are oftentimes things that I strongly disagree with. And sometimes I strongly disagree with Christians who we have on the show. And sometimes I strongly disagree with an atheist we have on the show. And, you know, I just like literally today, I had this fascinating conversation with somebody who's head of one of the divisions of Google, you know, head of moonshots for Google. And I found it a fascinating, hopeful, perplexing, head scratching, distressing conversation. And it was like that. It was so fascinating. And it terrifies me and also gives me some kind of hope, right? And so it's like I get to keep learning stuff. And I think the last thing I'll say about that is that I think that for me, a lot of times, the taking this approach of trying to have these hospitable, generous conversations in public is that, you know, it saddens me that so many Christians in public are just so foment hostility.
Yes.
As opposed to trying to have respectful, fruitful conversation and to treat people with respect. And so sometimes I just think, you know, it's incumbent upon many of us, I think, to try to give a counterexample to that.
Yes.
By saying, you know, we can be Christians and can show up in public and be good neighbors by cultivating these sorts of interesting conversations in a respectful way. And so it's a sort of counter, you know, it's a counter narrative to what so many have presumed it means to be Christian in public.
Yeah. I appreciate you saying that. A lot of our listeners, I think, are coming out of faith traditions or a way of inhabiting their faith where that was seen the hostile, coercive, combative kind of nature of interacting with people from other faiths, that was seen as the only way or the best way to engage. And there was some sort of compromise if you were going to be kind, you know, or generous or appreciative, you know, in your conversation. And so I really appreciate you saying that it's actually an outworking of your Christian faith to be appreciative of others, to listen to what they have to say and to honor their perspectives, even if you disagree.
Right. The other thing I'll also add about that, since Matt asked me about that book, Who Is My Enemy? That was a conversation with the Muslim tradition. One of the things I discovered in doing that book is that I got to know a number of very high-profile, very thoughtful Muslim scholars when I was writing that book. And, you know, one of my fondest memories of that decade of my life was getting to go to the Mount of Olives, to the home of a Muslim theologian, and who fed us this wonderful, wonderful meal. You know, and it's like it was a privilege to get to be in conversation with these folks who were so thoughtful and so attentive to the kinds of arguments that they were making. Well, what I discovered was that I grew in an appreciation for the Islamic tradition, while also knowing that's not my tradition, and there are certain things about that I respect and appreciate, and there are certain things about it that I simply disagree with and do not find helpful. And knowing it's a very different story than the story revealed, those claims that we have about who God is revealed in Jesus of Nazareth. Right. They're different stories. Some overlap, but different stories. And yet what I discovered in that was that I was better able to understand my own faith as a Christian because I was willing to have thoughtful conversations with a devout set of Muslims. They helped me understand better the claims I was making, the claims I thought I was trying to live by. And so it wasn't, not only were they, did I not experience that as a threat to my faith, I experienced it as a helpful cultivation of my faith because I was willing to have those kinds of conversations. And I find that over and over again to be the case with all sorts of people.
Yeah. it strikes me, Lee, that one of the practices or habits of the good life is being able to do that, is being able to abide and appreciate and learn from difference without making uniformity or collapsing difference into mm-hmm. some sort of lowest common denominator sameness. I did want to ask you about, you know, in these interviews you've had, I want to ask you like what you've learned about the good life, and maybe in particular, maybe what you've learned from people outside of our tradition or a person outside of our tradition that feels like it's like maybe a concrete example of what you experienced from these Muslims, you know, where someone from outside your tradition helped teach you something that made you more at home in your tradition.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of three immediately popped in my head, so I'll try to hit these really quickly. Oliver Berkman, Englishman, who wrote the book 4,000 Weeks. I often think about my interview with him and about his book.
Ben talks about that book a lot.
Really?
It was a fantastic. I'm so glad I found Oliver Berkman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic read.
So. Yeah, it is. And the conversation we had with him was lovely. Mm. And, you know, I remember sitting in a place at the time that's now closed down, but at the time that I like to go to get craft beer and drink a beer in the afternoon and read, and reading his book. And he has this one passage where he's talking about how we always tend to ask questions about why are things the way they are. And he suggested, you know, what if we just take the posture of wonder that things are and wonder that we are alive? And, you know, I just found that so, and it was almost like this sort of mystical moment where I'm sitting here drinking that beer, reading those words, and then looking around this room at everyone that was around me and thinking, this is amazing. It's amazing that we're alive, you know, and it's amazing that we have this little bit of community here. And it's amazing that people have worked at the craft of making these brews this way, and that we can sit here and read and think and be alive and know that we're alive, you know. And so repeatedly I've had that kind of experience of reminding myself of things that Oliver said about that. Another one super helpful, Kristen Neff, who's done a lot of this research. She's at UT Austin. She's done all this interesting research on self-compassion. And, you know, I was raised in a kind of Christian tradition in which self-compassion was at least seemed to me, we were kind of taught that that's kind of dangerous, you know, yeah, to be compassionate to oneself. Yes. And so what I've learned is that, not only is it not dangerous, it's dangerous not to practice self-compassion. And so she helped me, and she helped give me some very concrete ways to do this, you know, namely in this, it sounds woo-woo, but in writing a compassionate letter to oneself for 7 days in a row, in which you act as if you are a friend, you take the voice of a friend and you write yourself a letter about the difficult things that you're going through. And you do it like you treat oneself as you would treat a good friend. Yeah. And that's been a super helpful kind of thing as well, that I've learned something that helps me practice my own Christian faith. And I had three, but I don't remember what the third one was at the moment.
Yeah.
And now a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
You know, I was just thinking about, you know, almost that little qualification that you made about the writing the letter to yourself, that it sounds a bit woo-woo. You know, I wonder if that is part of our defense mechanism that keeps us away from self-compassion. Because there's been so many people who've told me, I'm just thinking about a friend who their therapist just recommended, look at yourself in the mirror and just say to yourself, I love you. Mm. And she told me it was so hard to do the first time. It was so hard to do. Like, it's much easier for her to say, she was telling me this, it's much easier for me to say, I know God loves me. I know I am loved. I know you love me. But for her to look at herself and say, I love you, was deeply challenging, but also deeply healing once she started doing it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wonder about, like, what is it in us that, I don't know, maybe it's the fear of the vulnerability of it or something, but, you know, there's a defense there. Like, oh, that's woo-woo. That's, I don't need that.
Yeah. 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 I don't mind the implicit way you just called me out there, Ben.
No, I
but it's fair. It's fair enough though. I mean, I will say that I have a number of times when I talk about this, and I think the most recently I mentioned this in a newsletter we sent out, and I use that phrase. It sounds woo woo, you know, but I know internally what I'm doing is I'm preemptively giving myself a defense of those who are going to so immediately dismiss it.
Yeah,
and thereby judge me for suggesting such a thing, right?
So I did think, tricky. I you know, halfway through that, I did think, I hope Lee doesn't think I'm calling him out here. because truly, I resonated with it, and I think there could be some benefit, you know, maybe to say like, hey, I know this might sound a little strange to you, but I would encourage you to be open to it, right?
Yeah.
That kind of a thing.
Right.
But there's also, I'm also very familiar with that for my own like defense against accusation, that sometimes I'll qualify things like that,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
So anyway.
Mm. Well, maybe as we get ready to wrap up here, Lee, and I do wonder like what your hope is for No Small Endeavor and how that fits into your overall, what you see your vocation as these days. I know you teach at Lipscomb. You host these live events. You curate these conversations. Like, what is the telos for you? What are you hoping that the gift that this is for others?
Yeah, I mean, as I indicated earlier, I mean, I have tried to frame my own sense of the telos of my life in terms of. For example, Irenaeus is the glory of God's a human being fully alive. Of Aquinas' notion that we're on this journey towards a consummate friendship with God. And in that process, we can know deep friendship with others who are on that journey with us and know a sort of real happiness in that process. Or the Westminster Catechism, the end of humankind is to glorify God and enjoy God. And so I think of my own sort of telos in those terms, and I take kind of traditional Christian orthodoxy seriously about the eschatological vision of a new heaven and new earth, and that our task is to contribute, bear witness to the new heavens and new earth that have that has come in part and will come in fullness. And so I think that obviously I don't talk this way on public radio about what we're doing, because it wouldn't be helpful. But that's the way I personally frame what we're trying to do, is that it's simple work of trying to bear witness to something that we believe to be true and good, and to do it in the way that we carry on conversations and hoping that those conversations themselves can elucidate some possibilities for life that maybe a lot of us haven't yet imagined. And, you know, it's deeply rewarding to me. We hear from, I remember last year in the same week or a couple of weeks, we got on the one hand a nice long email from a pastor who said, I wanted you to know that I often use what I learn from No Small Endeavor in my sermon preparation. And I'm grateful for the work that you do because it helps me think about things I hadn't thought about and gives me new resources to do the work that I do. And then at the same time, we heard from a gentleman who apparently is a singer-songwriter in Nashville. And he said that he had discovered us one Sunday afternoon out doing his chores on public radio and had ended up stopping in the parking deck at Whole Foods and sitting in his car for a long time to hear the rest of the episode before he went in to do his grocery shopping. And that he said, you should know that I lost my faith a long time ago, and I do not believe in any kind of religion, but you've helped cultivate in me a new hope for the possibilities of being human. And I wanted to thank you for that. Hmm. And, you know, I'm deeply grateful for both of those kinds of feedback. We care very much about both of those kinds of audiences, and neither one is more important than the other. Because in both of those cases, It's like this joy that we get to participate in helping people do the work of bearing witness to what a good life might mean and a good life might entail. So it's wonderful work to get to do, and we're really, really grateful to get to do it.
Yeah. It just seems like necessary work in this time when economic and emotional and relational and mental dis-ease seems to be increasing. And, you know, there's a cost to even staying informed with the way that information is used these days.
Yeah.
And I think that the easy way is to numb out or bypass or bright side and hewing out the capacity for authentic wonder and joy. It feels like a survival.
Yeah.
It feels like survival for Christians, like fighting for hope, fighting for joy. And I think that No Small Endeavor is a wonderful instrument unto that end. So thank you for your work and your faithfulness there.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Ben. And I'll say too, knowing, you know, my recollections of both of you are ordained Episcopalians, and I think that from my perspective, the difficulties laid upon pastors and rectors and ministers and priests has to be so intense right now, and how deeply we need the good work that you all are doing. And so it's just, you know, we're all kind of finding ourselves in various places of languishment. And so I'm deeply grateful for the work and the kinds of questions and the way you frame the work that you do. So I'm thankful for that.
Thanks, Lee. It's good to have you today.
Yeah.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
You know, Matt, I appreciated what Lee was sharing about kind of having that appreciative, open, generous conversation with people that you maybe disagree with theologically, right? Atheists, you know, Muslims, etc. But I was realizing too that many of the conversations that I think we're having and our listeners are having, where you're in a room with people who, you know, quote unquote, disagree with you, are with, you know, family who support Trump, or, you know, are sort of like heavily involved in MAGA and that kind of a thing. And I was just thinking about, I don't really have an answer for this. It's just a pondering that there's a, there's a different kind of difference there, right? Like a Muslim community inviting Christians to celebrate, what's it called? Iftar, which is like the breaking of the fast during Ramadan. I think I have that right.
All right.
My apologies.
I'm gonna let you cook.
My apologies if we don't have it right. But there's a difference between sort of celebrating a meal where we're all engaged in this posture of openness toward one another, even though it's like, okay, yeah, the Muslim story and the Christian story are very different. We have different visions of God because of it. And yet we can be kind to one another. We can sit down with one another. But that kind of difference, it feels fundamentally different to me than trying to sit down with somebody who wants to argue with you about sort of political facts, you know, that kind of a thing. So anyway, I've just been thinking about that difference, that there is, it feels to me like one of the things that needs to take place for those kinds of generative conversations to happen is that both parties need to agree to like inhabit that kind of space together. And that's one of the main problems with those political conversations as we try to have them today.
Yeah, I think there's something about the capacity to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And the willingness to value that.
Yes.
I tried to link that as constitutive or concomitant with the good life. Meaning, I don't think the good life is available when we have a rigid supremacist frame where all difference is met with attack.
Yeah.
Or trying to achieve uniformity.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Now there's levels to this and layers to this that probably are not appropriate for an outro to an interview. Right. you know, if you, if your difference is you want to harm my daughter, then it's not virtuous for me to abide and appreciate that difference.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So we're talking about difference here in a very niche or contextual way. Mm-hmm. Of for instance, having a meal with a Muslim friend. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we are talking about this in our discipleships in the streets class that we're doing right now in our.
We're doing it right now as we're recording this.
Yeah.
Who knows when this will be released?
Well, the good news is they're all being recorded and you can access them at Gravity Commons.
Gravitycommons.com/. We're going to have to create something, I guess.
Well, they can join the community. They can join the community and find it. Yeah,
yeah. Oh, actually, yes. Go to gravitycommons.com/reconstructing. For some reason, I just forgot about that. Yes, yes.
Yeah, I, like, I put it on a T for you, Ben.
You're and I was like, I don't know. I have no clue. Well, now that we hired an administrator, I have no idea how our website works.
She's
she's been doing great. Anyway.
Yeah. But I think that's... Being able to do that and seeing that as a good is something that's yes. that's not universal.
Right, right. That's sort of the minimum viable assumptions, the minimum viable commitments mm-hmm. that are required to have that kind of conversation. Yeah. And I think there is a goodness. I think that is part of living the good life, you know, I would contend. That my conversations with people who are not Christians and who are not convinced of the same sort of theological doctrines that I am, my conversations with people like that now are so much more life-giving for me and for them than they were when I thought I was supposed to be, to use Danny Bryant's phrase, a deputy of shame that coerced and convinced them that what they were doing was wrong and shameful and bad. And they needed to do what I was doing. Like when I was taught that I was supposed to be a deputy of shame, I hated those conversations. Absolutely hated them. I think there was something deep in my bones that knew this is not good.
Yes.
But I was told it was good.
Yep.
But there was some sort of paradigm shift that happened for me where I just dropped it. I was like, well, maybe that's just not good and I just don't have to do that. Maybe there's a different way to do this. And I just had like 2 weeks ago, had a wonderful conversation with a complete stranger. It was somebody that came over to our house. It was a partner of one of the people my wife invited over, some people from her cohort at school. Anyway, and you know, just had a wonderful conversation with this guy who's a Buddhist. And, you know, he asked me about, he goes, oh, you grew up like evangelical and you became an Episcopal priest. Tell me about that. And we had like a really long conversation and I found myself, sharing my faith in ways that like I felt impossible before. And I think part of it was there's just no pressure and no shame. Like he was genuinely curious about my experience of God. And I was like happy to share with him. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I sat with wonder during that conversation thinking, this is hilarious that I'm sharing my faith with a Buddhist. But it means something completely different than it would have meant 30 years ago to me.
Yeah, well, the difference is 20 years ago. First of all, I'm really glad you put down your badge and your gun, deputy. Secondly, yeah.
I was a pretty bad deputy. So, to my credit, probably.
When you're a deputy, you're trying to figure out how to get people who aren't hungry to open their mouth and eat the donut in your hand.
Right. This is good for you. Believe me. Yes.
But this is more of like somebody saying, hey, do you have something to eat?
Yeah.
You know?
Or tell me about the thing that you just ate.
Yeah.
That you enjoyed eating.
Tell me about what you eat. Yeah. Tell me about your diet.
Yeah.
And I think there's such a freedom in that, and it lowers the anxiety. And it reminds me that my shift from being the sheriff, the shame sheriff, to where I am now, it was people like that Buddhist person in your living room, who actually treated me in a way that I wasn't treating others, And I experienced the goodness of it. And even in those moments, some of them were asynchronous online, some of them were in person. In those moments when they were treating me good and I tried to do my thing, mm-hmm. my bones knew that I was transgressing something.
Yeah. Like they risk something with you and you're turning it into something different.
Yeah. Right? I mean, yeah. And they didn't slap me or trip me or anything, you know, like they treated me kindly. But I think what I'm saying is before I knew how to explain it or before I actually had like a rational explanation for why, my body knew it was wrong.
Yeah.
And my body also knew how they were treating me was right. Mm hmm. And I'm just bragging about my body right now.
No, I think
I got a pretty good body.
It's not just your body, you know.
No. It's all my body, no,
Matt. Your body's not unique. You are not unique.
I'm just saying. Like I think my body knew what was up before my mind.
Yeah, that was my experience too. Like I felt it. It was wrong. And yeah, my body knew it, but I was told that wasn't the Holy Spirit. Yeah. You know, that's your body doesn't know anything. That's you being ashamed of the gospel, you know, or whatever. And so anyway, that's another paradigm shift is just learning, you know, I mean, obviously our bodies can get things wrong. There is such a thing as disordered passion, disordered desire.
Yes.
But there's also such a thing as the Holy Spirit. And sometimes the way that I think the Holy Spirit speaks to us is through that wrench in our guts when we transgress something that we should not have transgressed, right? Mm, I mean, now we're just talking about good old-fashioned conviction of sin.
Or sometimes the wrench in your gut is because you had two hot dogs for breakfast.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Or or three. Or a hot dog bowl.
The other thing that...
Sorry. Some niche humor here. So
you smell like hot dogs. Gosh, what a skit. What a skit. The other thing that I was noticing was I was really glad that Lee talked about practicing self-compassion.
Yeah.
Man, that feels transgressive, doesn't it? You know?
Yep.
Like
yeah, that's
it feels self-indulgent, it feels prideful. It feels narcissistic. Oh, that's a scare word, right? And I think we have entire theologies built upon a shameful self and reinforcing a shameful self as a lever to pull to get people to move towards Jesus. Yeah. And so even for those of us maybe who aren't overcoming or healing from that kind of spiritual mistreatment, practicing self-compassion, not as like a luxury, but as a necessity. Mm-hmm. I honestly think practicing self-compassion in our increasingly hostile world, dehumanizing world, where we're filled with fear, real fear, listener, not just imagined fear, but like real fear. Yeah. Practicing like things like self-compassion and like fighting for joy will become survival tactics to not lose our humanity.
Yeah.
They have.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
You know what else we'll need? We'll need jokes. So here's one, Ben.
Oh, I was going to say weapons to fight off the zombies. No. Okay.
But if you've got weapons...
But if you do have them, just in case.
Hot dogs.
You never know. You never know when the zombie apocalypse is going to happen.
Hot dogs are not weapons, though. They're food weapons, kind of. Ben, how did Harry Potter get down the hill?
I don't know.
Walking, J.K. Rowling.
Rowling.
He went rolling down the hill.
Rowling. JK, Rowling. That was pretty bad. I'm almost tempted to just follow it up. If I could think of a good joke, I would just follow it up to say like, oh, I'm so sorry.
But you can't.
I'm so sorry. Yeah. All right. Well, no follow-up joke. That was the end of the episode, and I'm very sorry.
Do we need to put a trigger warning at the beginning of this episode that there's a J.K. Rowling joke?
I don't think so.
Because she's, you know.
She is. She's become.
She keeps outdoing herself and problematic and sort of ruining her legacy.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah. Weird.
Why are you anyway, doing that?
One promise I'll make to listeners, if I become a multimillionaire, I will delete all social media. So if you'd like, if you'd like to see me post less, you can make your check out too. All right, listener, we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the start recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.